This is Melissa Swank, graduate student at Portland State University. Today is Thursday, February 23rd, 2012. I'm interviewing David Vernier, co-founder of Vernier Technology and Software at his office in Beaverton, Oregon. Do you give consent to have this interview recorded?
Yeah, the technical name is Vernier Software and Technology. You just had the words back. No big deal.
Well, now we have it on record. So I want to start with your full name, date of birth, birthplace, and kind of a little bit of family structure.
David L. Vernier. David Lloyd Vernier, born February 7th, 1947, although I look a lot younger. From Dayton, Ohio, Ohio area, and went to school in Ohio. Went to Ohio State, went to community college, then went to Ohio State. And met my wife there, and she still works here, and she's the co-founder, and we still work together every day. So,
what did you study at Ohio State?
Physics.
Physics. What drew you to the science field?
Well, I always was a science person. Rector sets and chemistry kits and stuff like that. Chemistry sets and remember also this was the time of the Sputnik thing, and we were trying to catch up with the Russians, and I do think we had better. A little bit of a burst of science education. Some extra resources were thrown at science teachers, and they got some extra training. And so there was a real push to get kids in science, and it worked for me. But I think it didn't need to work for me because I just liked science anyway.
Did your parents foster that, or was it
not so much my parents? My dad only had about a fifth grade education, but he was a very well read person and certainly inquisitive and stuff. But it wasn't like he was a scientist or something, so.
Do you remember your first computer?
Good heavens, of course I do, because that was a big change in my life, because what happened, the whole company comes out about because of computers. First of all, I took a computer class only one computer class in college. It was in Fortran. It was horrible. It was boring. You turned in a bunch of cards and came back 2 days later to see if your program ran. And it was pretty brutally boring, but I did it for credit. And then when I went to Hillsborough High School to start teaching, this is after I'd gotten a master's degree and came out to Oregon, the business education teacher had terminals in her room, and they used them really to teach typing more than anything else. But it was there were, I think, four teletype terminals that kids could type on. It was a timeshare thing. It was really run by the Educational Service District, and so during the day she would have the kids come in there and type, and they'd submit reports or whatever, and there was some interaction, but mostly it was about typing. And so I knew her, and I worked out a deal where after school I could go in there and use those terminals, and so I did, and I used them all the time. I worked there 3 or 4 hours a day every evening. And I would do things like write programs to do the grades for my kids. And I just started doing physics programs, little simulations of physics things. Remember, this is a teletype. It's all on paper, so it's not very graphic. But you could do calculations. And for example, I could do computer-generated tests. So every kid had a different test, so they couldn't copy answers and stuff. I started to see ways that computers could be used for teaching. And then, not long after that, I got Tektronix was a big player in this area in those days, and they made graphic terminals. So you could think of it as a big calculator, the size of a large typewriter, or bigger than that even, great big typewriter-like thing. And then next to it, there was a graphic terminal. It was sort of like a small TV screen, which you could actually draw things on. And so this was the first computer that I ever saw that you could really do graphics on. I could make simulations of things, like I could simulate satellite orbiting and how you get a satellite to go out to the moon and back and stuff. And remember, we were sending people to the moon in those days, so that was a big interest to teachers and some kids. So I started doing simulation programs, and I learned programming on my own, and did those with Tektronix calculator thing. And then, not long after that, you actually could start to buy computers. And so I bought, this is before Apple II, there were a few models you could get for $1,000 or so, extremely crude. I think my first one I bought for the school was a Sorcerer. And it was a simple computer, but it would do graphics. And the nice thing about that is then I could at least bring that home and work at home. Mm-hmm. So my wife's not so furious that I'm working every night at the office. That's cool. And then finally when Apple II came out, I bought one of those personally and started writing programs for Apple II. And so I certainly remember my first computers, plural.
Mm-hmm. What drew you out to Oregon in the first place?
Well, you have to remember that, first of all, I taught in 4 years in the ghettos of Cleveland, Ohio. And then I'd been out west with my dad, who we did the traditional East Coast person driving across the country in the summertime with the kids. But my wife had never been west at all, and we were young, and we wanted to, you know, go to somewhere exciting. Oregon had a great reputation in those days for being a leader in environmental things, and that really impressed us. Things like the beach bill and the bottle bill and urban growth boundaries, things like that. So we came out to Oregon as a adventure, but I went to Oregon State to get my master's degree was the specific thing. And then when I got my master's, we left Oregon and we looked for a job here.
So it was work that kept you here once you were here?
Well, I would say it was more Oregon. In those days, I could have gotten a job anywhere, I think.
Mm-hmm. Did you search more around the Corvallis area, or did you...
I think the answer is we probably would have gone almost anywhere that was a good job, mm-hmm. but I think we would have very quickly learned that we're city people, and we would have been bored out of our skulls in a small town. Even Corvallis was absolutely great. You can imagine coming from the ghettos of Cleveland to Corvallis, Oregon, where nobody even locked their doors. Mm-hmm. It was. We used to make jokes about it. It's like Father Knows Best or something like that. We're going from places where there literally are gunshots to a place where everybody knows everybody. And
mm-hmm. Did you and your wife have any children?
No kids.
So just the two of you.
Yeah, we didn't ever want any kids and have no regrets about that decision.
Uh-huh. That you had your kids in the classroom.
We sure did. We also have about 100 employees here, and we sort of take care of them to some extent.
Mm-hmm. When you bring up your employees, some of the research described some of these tech companies as family-like. Mm-hmm. Would you say the same is true here?
I would, very much so. I think we've been on the best places to work in Oregon list for 13 straight years, and I think one of the reasons is that we do have a sort of a family feel here. We have a lot of parties and stuff. We have, today I'm passing out Timbers tickets. We've got four season tickets to Timbers, and we're passing those out to people. Had a drawing to see who gets them, and we have soccer games on Mondays and Wednesdays at lunch, and volleyball games on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and stretching kind of a class on Wednesday, and on Friday we have both yoga and full court basketball, and we have a lot of events. Like just last week we had movie day, which was, we shut the office down and we usually all get on the Max and go downtown together to go to some movie. We pick a time when you can get maybe 10 different movies that start roughly at the same time, and so people can pick which one they want to go see. And hopefully it leads to discussion on the train on the way down there about which movie you're going to see, and then on the way back, what did you think? And so we think it's a good socializing thing. And all those events are done with everybody in the company working together. And we very much have promoted the idea that nobody's better than anybody else. And we have everyone here we have four PhDs, scientists, and we have people that fill boxes all day long. Mm. So it's quite a mix of people. So,
did you know when the company started, or when did you realize that you wanted that social interaction really to be a fundamental part of the company?
You know, there never was a discussion, because it's just the right thing to do. So, I mean, it's just an obvious thing. a slightly funny story related to that was how we got our first office. We started the company almost by accident because I was doing these things for my class, and we said, well, let's see if those could be useful to other teachers. I'll just spend the summer writing these programs, and then we'll try to sell them. And worst case scenario, I'll have better stuff for my kids. Best case scenario, maybe we sell them. And so that's how the company started. So we puttered around like that for a year or so, and finally we said, well, you know, if we're going to be serious about this, we better have somebody here to answer the phone. Remember, there's no internet or anything. So schools would call and try to order, and there's no one to answer the phone. That's kind of embarrassing. Mm-hmm. So my wife quit her job, and she became the first employee, and she would stay home and work on all the business stuff. If the phone rang, take an order, and stuff like that. And then I would help her in the evening, and we'd ship the orders out and stuff like that. And then gradually we decided we're not developing much new stuff because I'm teaching all the time. So I quit. I took a leave of absence, and she went back and worked at Nike, actually, to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. So then finally, after another couple of years, we both quit, and there's two of us are home working. And it even got busy enough that we said, well, you know, we ought to have an employee to help because there's just too much to do. So we hired this a little bit older woman, nice woman, and she would come to our house. It was still working in our house, and we'd work away in the morning, and then every day, this about 10 or 11 o'clock, Christine or I would say, think to ourselves, oh my God, what are we going to have for lunch? Because we come from the Midwest, and I think most people are this way. If someone's in your house, mm-hmm. you offer them food. So we felt absolutely compelled to cook Pat's lunch every day. Mm-hmm. So it became, and that was a lot of work because, you know, if it was just the two of us, we could have leftovers from the night before mm-hmm. or peanut butter and jelly sandwich or something. But with her, we felt, oh my God, we better plan our lunch. And so it was almost more work than it was worth. Mm-hmm. So we saw that right behind us there was an office building that had space available. And so that really is what drove us to rent that office space, because as soon as we got Pat and part of the office moved over there, we no longer felt any compulsion to cook Pat's lunch. It was more like, well, Pat, we're going to go to lunch now. I'll see you later. So that's, but anyway, I think that's somewhat related to your question.
So where was that first office?
Over in West Slope.
West Slope. And have there been many transitions from the time of that first office before?
Yeah, we were in West Slope for a long time, probably five different positions in that complex there by the Dairy Queen on Canyon Road. Mm-hmm. It used to be a Dairy Queen, now it's a something else.
Right.
Anyway, and then we moved over by Tillicum Tavern across the street from Jesuit High School, mm-hmm. and we added on to that building, actually. And then in 2000, we moved here. This is an old Tektronix building, but mm-hmm. Nike had gutted the inside of it, and Nike rented it in 1995 and gutted the inside. And so you're seeing here is a Nike remodel. It's like a Nike building inside an old Tektronix shell.
Which is very interesting, the evolution of mm-hmm. buildings there. Can you explain to me the first big project you worked on, or what you would classify as your first big project?
No, it's more like everything, all little things just kind of growing. I can't say that it just was more like an evolution. We started with little simple simulation programs on Apple II computers were the first mm-hmm. products, and then we, probably a revolutionary thing was and thank God we did this, we weren't making it. We were selling these programs for $18 a piece. That was a school site license. So all the school had to do was pay us $18 one time. Mm. And they could make as many copies as they wanted and use mm-hmm. it on as many computers as they wanted. And obviously we wouldn't be around if that's all we did, because we couldn't possibly afford to run a business. Mm. So, but I realized right away that you could use computers to measure things. For example, in the olden days, if you were a science teacher and you were doing a demonstration with a thermometer, say, showing kids something about how this reaction heats something up or something like that, there was no way to do that experiment. You would literally do stupid things like call Sally up to the front of the room and say, Sally, would you read the thermometer and tell the kids what it says? And she would read the thermometer, and then you'd do the demonstration, and then you'd say, Johnny, come up, tell the kids what the thermometer says. Isn't that exciting, you know, about the most boring thing in the world,
like that,
right?
Yeah.
So it didn't take much computer technology to make a temperature sensor that we could plug in the computer, and it would read a number on the screen, or not much harder than that, a simple graph, and so that you could at least have a little more interesting display for the kids when you did the experiment and get them a little bit more involved. And I would say that evolution of into making hardware like that was a big deal, because then that not only was it something we could sell multiple copies of, right? Because if it's in the best case scenario, the teacher buys one for demonstrations, and then down the road they say, man, this is really cool. When I get some money, I'm going to have one of those for each one of my groups of students around my lab. And so they might buy eight later, and that's the kind of evolution that happened. And now that's a pretty common thing now. A well-equipped school might have a setup for data collection with not only temperature sensors, but other sensors for each group of students.
So would you say that the students or the educators would be your primary focus when you're designing these things?
Well, it's all about the students, but we, our customers, our teachers, I mean, we've got to impress the teachers, and so we talk to teachers all the time. They know best. I mean, they know what they want to do when they, you know, so we do try to make a product that teachers would want to buy and use with their class. Most of our interactions with teachers. Mm-hmm. But remember, at least 15 people here used to be teachers, so we also have our own sort of basic background. But we always go to conferences. We're getting ready to go to the National Science Teachers Convention in late March, and about 25 of us are going, so it's a huge deal. And we'll spend 3 days standing there talking to teachers.
How do you find your employees that were once educators? Do they find you, or do you find them?
In general, some of both, but when we go looking for a teacher, it's not too hard, because a lot of them know us, and if we just put the word out that we're looking for somebody, I wonder if someone needs that room. Anyway, it's been pretty easy to hire former teachers, because it's a nice change of pace. You still feel like you're in education. Mm-hmm. You are teaching. You're teaching other teachers. And yet you don't have to grade papers, and you don't have that daily grind. It's a little different. So. You got a different daily grind, I should say.
How would you describe your daily grind?
Well, for most of us, like me, it's a mix of answering teachers' questions, helping develop new products, writing books, testing software. So I think for most of the former teacher types like me, they wouldn't complain about being bored. They might be complaining about being distracted in so many ways they can't get any work done, and it drives them crazy. They've got this project they want to get done, but yet the phone rings, and they all know that teachers come first. If that teacher needs an answer to a question, and stop your work and get that question answered.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably the more frustrating thing. But on the other hand, they've got a pretty good lifestyle, I think. Most of them travel about once a month around the country to go to a show or something. The young ones choose to do that more. And honestly, there's some of them that are going, you know, twice a month. They're flying to Orlando or New Orleans or somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they're working, but they also see in the country and having some good times.
Mm-hmm. Do you constantly have groups of people working on new things? Is that something that's...
Always new things. In fact, this is the 23rd. On March 1st, we announced probably the biggest new product in 5 years. So we're all scrambling to get that ready.
Mm-hmm. That's exciting. So you mentioned a little bit about the social aspects of work here. What does the rest of your work week look like? I mean, how do you balance out your work life and your personal life?
Well, Christine and I, for a long time, we didn't have much other than work. We worked all the time. We probably worked 80 hours a week for 25 years. But we didn't hate it. It was, you know, we liked what we were doing, and we're working together, and we're taking trips together, and you know, so. But we worked an awful lot. We've lately gotten more and more into board service. We've been on multiple boards. I'm on about three. She's on about three. So we're much more involved with board work now. But that just adds to the workload. Mm. But we do get. We're trying to take off earlier. And we're not working every weekend anymore. So, and we've definitely been traveling a lot. We've been traveling internationally even a couple times a year, and so we're working less, but way more than 40 hours a week.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel like your relationship with your wife has just? Do you feel like this company would be possible without her?
Well, I think if you interviewed people here, they and asked them who's the most important person, there would be no question that she would win. she's a great leader and very good at organizing things and getting things done and keeping people happy and stuff like that. So we've had an amazing, lucky combination. Most people are amazed that we can work together. It's 31 years of doing this. Mm. So a lot of people are amazed, but I'm not really. We get along quite well. We go on vacation together by ourselves most times and choose not to be around other people because we like to be together.
Mm. That's really nice. I want to ask you a series of questions on your challenges and successes here. What would you say has been the greatest success for the company?
Well, the greatest success, I think, has been an amazing, slow, steady growth. We 31 years, we've only had 1 year where our sales decreased, which is quite remarkable. We've always been profitable. We're the opposite of a dot-com with the huge upswings and the huge crashes. We've never laid a person off. Now, we hire temporary employees and because we know they're seasonal stuff, but we've never laid off a person that we've hired. And when we hire somebody, our commitment is to keep them as long as they're doing a good job. And I'm not saying we can always do that. We certainly can't guarantee that, but mm-hmm. we've made that effort. We certainly have provided a good workplace for a lot of people. We've provided good products at fair, affordable prices for teachers, and we've listened well to the teachers who tell us constantly that they're not good at technology, and we got to keep things simple. And so I think we're pretty good at listening to the teachers and providing a product that does what they need, and yet resisting the urge to make the world's greatest something. We're not going to make the world's greatest something. The world's greatest something is too expensive for a teacher to afford. We need to make a pretty good something that works well and is easy to use but doesn't cost a fortune. And that's a driving theme, and I think we do it pretty well.
Mm. What about challenges?
Well, those challenges, there's lots of them. Number one is schools don't have any money. So, you know, I think about like trying to sell something like a consumer product where you've got people that have, let's face it, people love to spend money on things like iPhones and iPads and stuff like that, and they have a lot more expendable money than schools do. So mm-hmm. sometimes we think, wow, wouldn't that be great? On the other hand, that's also a very up and down kind of business. Ours mm-hmm. is more steady, but that's number one challenge is that schools really are strapped for money, and we have to really work at keeping prices down. Number two challenge is that technology changes all the time. We're getting huge pressure right now to keep up with new devices that come along. And teachers call every day and say, hey, I just got some iPads for my class. What do you have for it? Well, we don't have very much right now. We better get on it. But that's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of development time to do that. So mm-hmm. we're doing that. But there's that pressure. And then you can always guess wrong. You might go down that route of spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then that thing fizzles. So far, we haven't done that too badly. But right now, here's a good question. Should we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop Android solutions with all the stuff that we do? I mean, we could literally shut the company down except for making Android applications, Android versions of all of our products for the next year. Mm. That might either be a huge win, or it might be a huge disaster, because who knows how it's going to go with iPhones versus Androids versus whatever else. So,
has that been a discussion?
Sure. And I think we'll probably do a modest, you know, dabble in Android, see how it goes without betting the farm on it. But, it could go the other way. What if Androids totally blow away iPads and people look back and say, why in the world did we waste that money on that iPad when this other one was so much cheaper? Mm. I mean, it's possible it could go that way. I don't think it will, frankly.
Excuse me. What has your personal greatest challenge in this field been?
Well, I think, I suppose I haven't done a great job at the work-life balance thing. Although we're doing better now. We probably worked too hard for all those years, and when you die, it's unlikely you're going to be sitting on that deathbed and saying, gee, I wish I had worked a little bit more. But I don't have any big regrets about that. So, personal challenges, I've enjoyed keeping up with the technology. I'm not great at some of the new stuff, but it keeps me busy, it keeps me active, and I think I've done an okay job being a leader in the sense of team leader, not in the sense of being the world's greatest CEO. I don't know a damn thing about business stuff. I never took a business class in my life, and I have great pride in that, for the record. I never will take a business class. I suppose I could have been a better leader in terms of being able to handle financial statements better and stuff like that, but it's not my cup of tea. I'd rather write a program.
And what about your personal success? What would you say is defining of your level of success?
Well, I was a teacher for 12 years, and I was a darn good science teacher, and I think I have helped a whole lot of science teachers become better science teachers because we've provided good tools for them. And I guess that's my greatest pride. And the other one would be creating this company, and a pretty successful company that's a lot of people like in a lot of ways, both people who work here and a lot of our customers. Mm.
So, we'll move on to a place question. Why do you continue to live in Washington County? Or do you live in Washington County?
Actually, we live in downtown Portland, pretty much, northwest Portland. Gradually over our life, we lived in Hillsboro, then we moved to West Slope, then we moved to Portland, but a little bit out of town, just walking distance from downtown. But now we live northwest. We just are city people. We like walking to restaurants and bars and grocery stores. And, if I can go the weekend without getting in a car, I'm just happy as a clam. We bought this building because it's on the MAX line, and it's right. The MAX stops right there. We took the MAX to work today. We just think it's... I just feel walkability is a real key feature of choosing where you live. If you can walk to things, it's a better place to live. That's my opinion. I just don't like this idea of you can't do anything without getting in a car.
What are some of your favorite places in downtown?
Well, we just went to South Park last night. Mingo's right there on 21st near our house. Typhoon was until it closed. Mm-hmm. 23 Hoyt is there. Lots of restaurants, lots of bars. And the nice thing is there's grocery stores too, so we actually cook more, I think, because we can walk home from the MAX and just walk by a grocery store, pick up some stuff and cook and not have to go out. So we're believers in the condo kind of lifestyle, but that's a personal thing.
But it's something that keeps you here too.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that the company you chose on the MAX line.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this idea of the Silicon Forest of the Washington County. Do you remember the first time you heard Silicon Forest?
I remember hearing that term. It's interesting. It had a little buzz there for a little while, and it doesn't get used as much, it seems like, anymore, maybe because the forest is I don't know, not blooming as much. I don't know. Although that Intel thing they're building is pretty amazing. I thought it was an interesting twist, and it's great that there is this little bit of electronics industry in Oregon. I just will tell one story. In 1981, the economy in this area was so bad that's really what sort of led this company to start, because my wife is working downtown. I'm teaching. Summer comes, and we don't have any kids, so we don't have a farm to take care of, or even land to take care of, or even a garden. Small garden, but so it's like, well, what am I going to do this summer? Well, I'm not about to let her get up at 5 in the morning and go to work and me just lounge around in bed all day. So I had to get a job. And the 81, it was so bad. I think it was worse than the last few years in terms of jobs. Well, you could look that up, but I think the economy was really worse. The fishing industry had gone, lumber was in a disaster.
Robin, you have a call on your extension.
Right. And I'm teaching, and I said, well, when school gets out, I'll go get a job somewhere, just make some little money during the summer. But it was so bad that the kids get out, and then we have a couple of days of teacher grading and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I went literally to McDonald's. I couldn't get a job. The kids got those jobs because they got out 2 days earlier, right? I couldn't get a job as a bartender. I literally couldn't get a job for the summer. So I said, hell with this. I'll spend the summer writing these programs, improving these programs that I use with my kids. Mm. And then at the end of the summer, we'll try to sell them. So that's how the company started. So it really did get sort of born out of recession. Had I gotten a job that summer, who knows what would have happened? I probably would have kept putzing around with the programs. Mm-hmm. But it might have been just a thing where every summer I putzed around with them. They got gradually better. And would it ever become a company? I don't know. So
it's a really neat
life story. Is what happens when you're busy making other plans, you know.
Yeah. It's really neat that it's something that is built out of that type of, you know, adversity. And you can't really plan on things like that. Yeah. When it comes to the Silicon Forest idea, do you see it similar or different from San Francisco's Silicon Valley?
Yeah, we're obviously very much a smaller. I got to say that we have almost no connection with any of that. We're so isolated. Uh-huh. I hardly ever talk to another business person, and I don't like to, frankly. Uh-huh. I'd really talk to teachers. So the last thing in the world I'd like to do is get together with a bunch of businessmen and talk. They're just not. I don't have anything in common with them. So I feel a bond to teachers and not to the business people. So I just can't say much about that. I just don't feel part of it.
Was there at any point that you had any
No,
kind of
I always, you know, I was a teacher. We started making products for teachers. I just feel like I'm a teacher that kind of does some business stuff.
So very independent from the rest of what you would say is going on.
So we do hire lots of technology companies around here to build things for us, or to design things for us, or to provide products, you know, but I personally don't have too much connection with those guys. But I guess we are involved, but I personally am not.
I see. So can you tell me about the relationship between Texas Instruments and...
Well, Texas Instruments, you know, makes those. First of all, it's a multi-billion-dollar company, and the division we worked with is, it seems strange. It is, I think it's a $5 billion company or something like that. Mm. But the division we work with is the calculator division, and that is amazingly run almost like a company our size. Mm-hmm. It's, and we in the good old days, starting in about 1994. We worked really, really, really closely with them, and we got to know them and had them over to our house, and because it wasn't like it was a huge company. It was like this little division that was not much bigger than us. Mm-hmm. And we worked together and the idea then was, remember, computers were pretty darn expensive in those days, so it was pretty rare to have a school that had enough money to buy multiple computers for their science classroom. Mm-hmm. So if you were a science teacher, a gung-ho science teacher who wants to do data collection, with all the, each group having their own station to take data, like temperature data. Darn few schools could afford to do that with computers, but many schools had the kids buying TI calculators. So what if we could take those TI calculators and make something to plug into them and then plug a temperature probe into that, and then that can be the station that takes the data. So that's what we developed, sort of working with TI, and that became a huge deal. In the late 90s, that was the hottest thing around, and we, our company probably doubled in size over that, and it really was quite a revolutionary thing, because it allowed teachers to do what they couldn't do before, which is have these multiple stations and kids actually doing science research in their own group. So, and we had a great relationship. We loved working with those guys. We jointly designed some products called LabPro and CBL2. That was in 1999, and so the early 2000s, we also were selling lots and lots of that stuff, and we were very much involved with TI. Lately, unfortunately, things happen, it's just a kind of evolution of hardware, such that we don't work together as closely as we did, and they might see us a little bit more as a competitor. But we still work together, but it's just not quite the same as it used to be.
Mm-hmm. What are your latest projects that you're working on and companies you're working on?
I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you.
Okay. Well, apart from the killing part...
No, we have this new thing that's going to be announced on March 1st, which is a new way to collect data, and we're more involved with using Wi-Fi and getting data streaming to things like iPads and stuff like that. So it's quite a revolutionary thing. It's going to take some time to finish up and really perfect, but we're announcing it on March 1st. Not sooner.
And this will not be released before that date. It's on the tape. Can you tell me about the ways that you see this company influencing the community around it, the ways that you give back?
Well, I think you would find you won't find many companies that have done more philanthropically. We just won the award from we've won the Outstanding Philanthropic Corporation Award several years ago. We've won the Nature Conservancy Business Partner Award. As I mentioned before, Christine and I are on lots of boards. When they have those lists of philanthropic companies every year, we're on that list. I think, frankly, we're underrated, because what happens is Christine and I personally donate a lot of money in the name of Vernier Software or in our own name. And if you lumped all that together, we donate millions of dollars a year to the community for good causes. Including, I mean, I could go on and on, but OMSI, both all the education foundations, Beaverton Hillsdale, Beaverton Hillsboro, and Portland, and anything having to do with education, robotics tournaments, Saturday Academy, you know, virtually anything having to do with education.
Is that science exclusive, or
we tend to focus on the science stuff, but not totally. I mean, Portland Schools Foundation, now called All Hands Raised, we donate money there, and they use it for whatever they want to use it for. A lot of things like FIRST Robotics or Top Robotics Tournament, that's kind of science engineering oriented, so we tend to focus on those. OMSI, we've donated a lot to. We also have donated a lot to Portland State, Oregon State, some to Oregon even. So so I think we are, I don't think there's a better company on philanthropy in the state per person. I mean, some give more money, but not per person.
So what causes you to stay in the area? Is it completely...
Inertia.
Inertia.
No, we love being here. We think it's a great place to live. The weather's not the greatest in the winter, but it's sure better than back east. And both in the winter and summer. I mean, I do not understand why people live in the east. It's hot in the summer. It's cold in the winter. we have all the natural wonders, although Cassine and I don't get out and see them as much as we should. But it makes no sense at all to me. Why a person would live in the East is absolutely beyond me. The only thing I can think of good is they can fly to Europe in about 4 hours. That's good for a vacation or something.
Do you feel like the company would have developed differently had it been in a different part of the world?
You know, it's so hard to say because it's just, it kind of evolved. It's not, it's so different than saying we have this plan and we own this. For the first 2 years, we'll do this, and then there was nothing like that. I mean, it is accidental.
Flexibility. Yeah. You went with it.
The answer is I can't imagine. I just, it's hard to know. But I guess it could have. And there would have been some advantages. I mean, frankly, Oregon's not the greatest place for in terms of shipping stuff. You know, if you wanted a place that you could develop products and ship them off quickly, and it might be good to be in Kansas City. But I can't think of very many other reasons to be in Kansas City. Well, you know, somewhere in the middle of the country. There was a time, this was kind of, I think, interesting. There was a time when my wife and I were almost the only employees. There might have been two or three other, but they were not like career people. They were just helpers. And we would go around the country to like physics teacher conventions and science teacher conventions together and, you know, go to fly to wherever it was, Topeka, Kansas for a convention. And we would, you know, have dinner and do our work and then look around the town a little bit. And we would always make the joke about, do you want to move here? Because we could have. There was a time when there were no strings attached. We had, we could have moved just like that. And we did play that game a little. And the only places we considered, we really liked Ashland. But we went there for a conference. But we realized that was not a good place to fly out of because it, you know, such a pain in the rear to fly to, say, New York from there. So that was rejected. And then we really liked Seattle because we liked cities, but traffic was so terrible. We said, oh, hell with this. I'm not doing that. So we liked Portland a lot, but and it was had so no place percolated to the top. And literally we went to 100 cities around the country, and we always played that game.
So. You've brought up conferences several times or conventions that you and your employees go to. How do those things work? Do you plan? Do you all plan to go together? Or
The most normal thing is it's a relatively small conference, say the National Biology Teachers Conference. We might send three people. And we have a booth, maybe it's a 10-foot by 20-foot booth, and we have a backdrop, and all of our biology-related products would be laid out, and those people would essentially stand there for 3 days as teachers walk by and show. Then they would typically do workshops, too. So maybe one of them stays in the booth, and the other two go off for an hour and do a workshop where teachers can sign up, and it's like a classroom, and they actually do... do like labs, and so they the hope is that they would do those and say, well, that was fun, and if I ever get some money, I'll buy that for my class. And we've been doing that for 30 years.
Do you run some of the workshops yourself? Or?
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to do some in late March, but mostly now it's other people.
So. Do you feel like a mentor to your employees?
A little bit, but but it's like I don't think they need a tremendous amount of mentoring. Remember, they're all most of them are former teachers, and they feel great pride in their teaching ability. So it's not like I make a real effort to be a mentor, other than maybe by as an example and being nice to our customers and stuff like that.
Well, here's the legacy question.
Okay.
How do you want to be remembered?
Well. You know, we aren't having any kids, and we're giving everything away. So I'm sure there'll be. Fred Fields just recently died. There was a nice article. He did the same thing. He donated all his money to various causes, including OMSI and Portland Historical Society and Oregon Community Foundation. I think that'll probably happen. That one or the other of us will die. And the other one will finally give all that away. So, I think we'll be good philanthropists.
Very involved in the community, and it's a very large blessing, and I'm sure that there are many people that are very thankful for what you do. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
I think I've done most of the stories, most of the war stories. Let's see. I think that pretty much covers it.
That's great.
I can give you a quick tour if you'd like.
That would be great. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
And we can.
You can leave, Saffer, or whatever. This is the first ad from 1981.
Where did it?
In a thing called the AAPT announcer. It was a newsprint, very thin little thing they'd send to physics teachers, mostly promoting like their upcoming conferences and stuff like that. So it was real cheap. I think that ad cost $200 or something like that.
Did you know about it from
I was a physics teacher. There's a philanthropic award from Nature Conservancy.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
It's a LEED EV gold building. It's LEED, LEED EV means LEED for existing building. Most LEED is NC, new construction. These are the catalog covers, so you can see the sort of history of the company. And we really started in 81, but we didn't have catalog, and that's where Apple II only, and then gradually, so here we have IBM, Apple II, and then Macintosh just came in.
And then it's so funny because I remember these things from school, and when you're a kid, you don't really think about where they come from.
Right. This is the best places to work for Fox.
These are various awards.
We'll just give it real quick. We've been on the best places to work, but we've also been on the fastest growing companies list quite a few times. Been on best green companies to work for and healthiest companies to work for. Now this all came with Nike connection. So this is ground up tennis shoes and tires. So Nike gutted the inside, and this is they like to have a sort of funky look for their young employees, which is perfect.
It's pretty fun here.
This is engineering. This is product finishing. So they're getting product ready for on the door.
But then
this is a little handheld computer that we make, and teachers plug sensors into it. Kids
so different sensors
measure
go into
temperature.
These.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
This is more. We call this production, but they're really testing and calibrating things. So, like she's been testing. We tested.
An H4.
Oh, okay. So the sensor for ammonia.
The sensor, yeah, ammonia.
Chemistry. So then over here we have more engineering. And this is like engineering and also repairs. Here is the. This is the actual warehouse. So this is the stuff. Right. And then we write lots of books, too. So here's like an advanced chemistry book. So that's how to use our sensors to... let me show you. So this is a blood pressure sensor. Now, we sell this not for doctors. In fact, we don't want you to use it for medicine. It's just to show kids what the idea of how to use your blood pressure. And so we have here's one. Let's see what it says. Voltage, just water voltage. So lots and lots of sensors.
A huge variety of things.
And then books on how to use them. Then over here we have these are pictures of people. This is purchasing.
So if someone has a problem with the product, does it come here for repair?
Unless it's international, and then it's more common. Here's a classroom where we do teacher training. Senator Merkley was here on Monday for a press conference. We got to use it. It was about healthcare, women's healthcare. This is a workout room, and then we have a gym there, and a little bit of basketball court.
You and that's where never we have to leave this place.
That's where we have our yoga classes and our basketball games. And then
I read in passing that President Obama was here.
Yeah, I'll show you a picture. He was here in May when he was running for president. It was May. Remember, Oregon is such a wimpy little state. They don't spend a lot of time here, and they're not going to spend much time here.
Chris, I put tickets on your desk.
Yeah, it sounds like
it. Okay. So this is in, you see me? These guys, this is where all the stuff comes in and they get it to the right place. This is IT, more engineering. Now this is my kind of interesting. This is the room where they get stuff ready to go shows. The shows you asked about.
Yeah.
So like those black boxes will all be filled up and sent off. Either maybe some of them might be going to a small show. Maybe doing maybe 5 or 6 boxes and a couple of people. But they're also getting ready now for this National Science Teachers thing with the 25 people, and it'll be literally truckloads of stuff. So they're starting to gather that now. Hmm.
This is our HR person. This is software QA.
This is where they test the software.
This is marketing. So we have a really great marketing department. This is a picture of him.
Well, he was Senator Obama in those days. And there's me, and there, you know, he's standing right there. It was not a rally. There were only our employees and the press.
How did that meeting happen?
Because Blumenauer's staff, I think is the answer. Mm. We know them really well, and they were sort of involved in setting it up. And, you know, you wanted to have a meeting. It was a meeting on the economy, and you know, better here than a bomb factory or something like that. You know, we make stuff for teachers. We have solar panels on the roof. It's a green building. You know, not a bad place to be. This is what we call tech support / R&D. So these are mostly former teachers helping the teachers, but also developing their own products.
And, you know, helping have something, writing a book, all those kind of things. These are some good books. All these cubicles in the office. That's a lab where we test things. There you can see some of the sensors.
All those are, you know, different sensors we make. So those are there so you can grab them and test them.
And over here.
So you're also working in health careers type products,
not doing medical diagnosis. That's the max stop. This is a place where we play volleyball and stuff. We have, like I say, 17,000 watts of solar panels. Every employee has a free transit pass.
Oh, that's nice.
We have special parking for carpools and hybrids. Those green things, signs are for Zip cars, shared cars. So if you work here and you have a free transit pass, you might consider a family might have only one car and take the train or use the Zip cars.
Yeah, the Zip cars are actually really nice. Yeah. I have a Zip card.
Well, there's one. If you ever want, you can pick them up there. Huh. Thanks for a little present.
No problem.
I'll take that.
I have the sufficient for deck bottles.
I want my one. Yeah. He's making homebrew beer. And he made
That is a nice gift.
This is software development in here. And then here's business stuff.
You're like, I stay out of that area.
Well, yeah. So that's a quick tour.
That is great.
Oh, I skipped this. I guess historically, I should have shown you one other place, some historical stuff.
Yeah.
Just a second here. You want some more coffee?
Oh, I'm okay.
Okay. Well, we do this. We have fruit merch time. There's a guy here whose brother works at a fruit market downtown Portland. And on Thursdays, he gets a whole bunch of fruit. We pay for it, but he delivers it, and that's great.
It's nice to have on hand.
It is. Now, this is a bit of a mess, but this is the old historical computer.
Oh, wow.
So, see, like Apple IIs and Macintoshes and Commodore 64 and old Windows, stuff like that.
And some of this is,
in general. Right now, we're kind of trying to rearrange those things. These are the really old computers. Like, this is the kind of stuff. This is an Altair. This was around way before Apple II.
Yeah, I've never seen one.
This is Steve Jobs' computer after he left Apple, the next computer. Mm. And these are old Tektronix scopes. And these are the guys who founded Tektronix, Murdoch and Bull.
That's right.
So,
kind of my little shrine. To
you're like my tribute.
Yeah.
Here. Oh, that's so great. It's funny. I've never seen half this stuff.
Yeah. Well, you're too young.
I'm not that young, that's though. A good thing. I like this.
Yeah.
But my wife's niece made that back in the old days when they used to send those to you in the mail all the time.
Oh, I remember.
And I couldn't bear to throw them away, so I said, let's do something with them. And
that's
she
pretty
was a
creative.
Creative young girl. She made them. She's now an engineer at Intel.
Okay. You think you got what you needed?
That's great. Thank you so much for your time and
yeah. If you have questions, let me know.
Yeah. And if